Hello, my loyal minions, and welcome back to the show. This is the Beer Truth Podcast, and today we have a conversation with Chris Loring, founder of Notch Brewing. That might sound familiar. If it does, that is because it is. This is round two with Notch and Chris, but hear me out. The first one was back during the, you know, relatively early COVID times, dark days, and it was via Zoom, so I convinced Chris to give me another hour. This interview was actually done at Notch's newer location in Brighton, neighborhood in Boston. It's a great spot to grab a beer or three, sit out in the gravel beer garden if it's nice, or if it's not as nice weather, sit inside. It's a really cool interior with wood paneling, and it's a cool place. This conversation, this round two, took place about 2 years, I think a little bit more actually, after our first conversation. And as you'll hear, a lot has changed during that time, including the opening of the location where we actually had this conversation. So a good bit of stuff to cover. So let's get to the conversation. If you want to just quickly kind of reintroduce yourself and catch up on maybe just the happenings of opening Brighton and last year or so has been.
My name is Chris Loring, and I am the head brewer of Notch Brewing, owner, and we are sitting in our Brighton brewery tap room and beer garden. And this was built during the pandemic and opened a year ago in July, so 2021 in July in the Brighton neighborhood of Boston. We are in what's called the Charles River Speedway, and these are horse stables that were for a horse track that was on the Charles River in the early part of the 20th century, and then this building became a number of different things over the years, owned by the state. It's on the National Historic Register, and it was renovated over the course of the last 5 years. We're the anchor tenant of a couple of the companies in here, which are basically food stalls and event space, et cetera. So it's been a pretty dynamic space, and it's good to be in Boston. I originally started my career brewing in Boston way back in the 90s, so it's good to come back here again and brew here again.
Yeah, I saw you posted a picture of a Tremont keg the other day.
Yeah, it was funny. So the Tremont was a brewery that was in existence for just about a decade in the Charlestown neighborhood. And I used the same wholesaler for Boston as we used during the Tremont days. And I went into the warehouse like a few years ago, and a guy pulled me up and goes, "Hey, are these your kegs?" I thought they'd be Notch kegs, right? And they're Tremont kegs that have been sitting, came back from the field somewhere like 15 years later.
Yeah.
And so we put them into rotation here, and every once in a while it pops up, and I kind of smile and laugh at it. Yeah. Still has the old sticker on it and all that.
The location, and you said opening during the pandemic, essentially, mm-hmm. But planning came before that.
Yeah, we started planning this 2018. And okay. it wasn't our intent, or my intent, to do a second taproom brewery after we built Salem, and Salem opened in 2016. But this proposition was pretty compelling in that the building is really unique. It doesn't feel cookie cutter. It feels very Notch. Like our Salem location has a definite feel and vibe that is hard to replicate, and so. The only way I would do it is if we had another kind of cool, interesting space. And this one feels definitely very, for lack of a better term, European, like German, Czech kind of, beer garden, beer hall, but on a smaller level. But you can sit in that beer garden, you never know you're in the city. All you see is trees and beautiful, the beautiful building that we're in. You can hear the Boston police right now, but so you can't totally escape the sounds.
Yeah.
But the beer garden's surrounded by this beautiful building, so you definitely feel like you're enveloped in this cool experience.
Yeah, it's... For a brewery that's less, are you 11 or just over, just under 11?
2010, we're 12 years old.
12, okay. It definitely feels like both of these places are, there's, like you said, other businesses here, but it feels like this is, it has the right vibe for what the brand is. I feel like everything, the artwork, the beer, the locations, all kind of match up.
Yeah, we kind of go for this timeless quality. We don't want to be dated, but we just don't want to be trendy, because you'll have to redo the place in 3 years. So we just didn't want to make this just a paint-by-numbers Disney World version of German or Czech beer halls. We wanted to have our own imprint on that. So they're highly influenced by that in terms of its feel and its service model and the seating and, you know, everything. But, you know, it's done in a way that feels notched. And we're not trying to, you know, fool you that you're in the Czech Republic. You know exactly where you are, but you're getting influenced by these beer styles and these beers that we create. And it's fun to drink them in an environment that's, you know, reminiscent of those countries.
Speaking of trendy, that was kind of where my first question was going. You know, there's breweries that make, you know, 7,000 barrels a year without ever repeating a beer. Which to me is like, you never know what to expect. And when you want consistency, you know, when I want the standard, it's always there. But it's kind of just the whole what's new and what's next and check it off on Untappd and post it on your story and all that. How do you keep people coming back when it's really the polar opposite of the trendy new hazy beer, different hop bill, or different written in a different order hop bill every week?
We don't brew styles that attract a consumer that's constantly looking to tick and try something new. If you're making traditional European, you know, Czech, German lager, you're not really getting a consumer that's like, you know, what's new today? Granted, we'll have new things and people are excited about it, but that's not the reason they show up. So we don't have the tyranny of five new beers every week or never brewing the same beer twice. We just don't attract that kind of customer. You largely attract a customer based upon what you do. So if all you do is new, you're going to get that customer. And they're going to want it in, you know, a paddle of tasters and flights and all that kind of stuff. We just don't do any of that. So we attract a customer that has just a different viewpoint and how they want to experience our tap rooms and our beer gardens. And just, again, nothing wrong with any of these approaches. They're just different approaches. So I think just based on how you do things, the beers you serve, the way you serve it, the way your tap room feels, the way you program, if you do program, it's all going to attract a certain consumer. And I think brewers know what they're doing and they want to attract that customer. For me, not brewing the same beer twice, how do you get good at anything? I mean, iteration is the key of all great product development. And if you don't iterate and try to do something the same to improve it or make tweaks, then you're always, I don't know, do you ever hit the nail on the head? And if you do hit the nail on the head, don't you want to brew that again? Right? Why would you move on?
Yeah.
I don't understand that thinking at all. I also question the validity if it's really different each time. I mean, we've all heard the New England IPA story about, you know, it's a base beer that has different hops each time, and the differences between those beers are pretty minute sometimes. So I don't know. I shouldn't comment on that approach because I don't do that approach. So I probably don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, to that point, there was, I don't remember which brewery, but they released a 4-pack and with 4 different labels on the beers, and every beer was the same beer, but they just wanted to see how people reacted to different labels of the same exact beer, and people rated them all differently. And like, oh, I like this one best and this one. And they're like, well, it's all the same beer.
Yeah. That's a fun exercise. I'm not sure I'd do that to my customer.
Yeah. It was great to watch in the comments section on social media, but
yeah.
So repeatability, all that stuff, you know, the beer garden, what do you do for, or what is it that you're doing right for this long to build this culture at Notch?
I don't know. I want to go back to the one repeatability thing first, and that one of the things that you know I drive in our breweries is this constant improvement. Like we never stand on our laurels. We never say we've done everything we need to do. We're always looking to make some improvement. And beer changes year to year because the ingredients you know are different each year, especially with global warming and the strains on our crops. Our water this year was much different because we had a drought, and from its composition to its temperature to the amount we had. You know, there were a lot of things changing. So as a brewer, you can't always do things the same way every single time and think the beer's always going to be the same thing. You have to constantly measure, adjust, and improve to hit that same goal. So, you know, it's not making the same beer all the time isn't as boring as it sounds. There's a challenge to make the same beer, you know, all the time at a really high level, but also try to, you know, have the continuous improvement. But I guess, you know, how do we get people in the door in those circumstances? Like, I've seen the ebbs and flows of the craft beer industry since the early 90s. And there's always trends that just come aboard and you ride them out. And people always come back to traditional styles. Gimmicks are always around. And gimmicks, you know, capture the imagination of the press, who are at fault for that. And they capture the imagination of those who are casually involved in beer. And that drives conversation. But when push comes to shove, you know, you'll see that, you know, these traditional styles, you know, tend to come back around again because they're like a familiar friend, and that's beer should be that. You know, it's okay to have some familiarity with something that is wonderful and tastes great, but you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And I always hear like, well, what's the new style trend? You know, what's going to be new? It's like, why? Why is that even a conversation? What's going to be new? What if nothing's new? Yeah. What if the things we do really well are just continue to be brewed really well and consumed? Right? This it's a U.S.-centric thing. Like, what's new? What's trendy? What's going to be next? Who cares? Have a great Pilsner. It's wonderful. It's going to be the same way in 100 years, and no one's going to look to change it. And Europe doesn't look at it that way. You know, they're much more mature beer scene there, and they're comfortable with themselves, and they have confidence that, hey, I don't need to go chasing trends. But the U.S. just loves to chase trends. I don't understand it as a consumer. But, you know, that I guess it goes back to that need for new. I just don't understand that, so we don't do it, and maybe that's why we just attract the kind of customers we have.
Yeah, I read an article recently. I can't remember where it was from, but it was about the Bavarian IPA, and it's like, oh, I've never heard of that. But then I started thinking, like, is American beer rubbing off a little too much on the old world traditions? Like, there's always going to be, you know, the innovation and all that. But like you said, you know, Pilsner in 100 years is probably going to be very recognizable.
It's still delicious.
Yeah, it's not going to, there's not going to be like, oh, well, you know, coconut flakes is now a standard ingredient in Pilsner. That's not gonna happen.
Right, and I think you'll see, you know, if you look back at the beer history of the last couple hundred years, there's always been evolving styles and movement in countries trying things that they've discovered elsewhere, but it hasn't been this like full sale like abandonment of something. It's just like, yeah, you know, we're gonna stick our toe in here and see if that works for us. Yeah. Bavarian IPA. I mean, it's inevitable. Like, there's really great hops being grown in Bavaria that have a fruity character, and so why not? Why not give that a shot? You know, but. I mean, I think you can do it in a way that's still true to the brewery. But again, each brewer has their own point of view, and they'll give you a different answer.
Yeah. Maybe they'll have taken some lessons from the monsters that American craft beer has created with different IPAs, different IPA styles, milkshake IPA.
Oh, I know. One thing that I don't like to see anyone fail. I want everyone to have success, but to see, you know, Stone cart out a pallet with, you know, German beer and then throw a stone, a big rock on top of it saying that we're going to come to, you know, Berlin and show everyone what good beer is. Like, holy shit, that's a lot of hubris. And that, you know,
yeah. Stone Berlin didn't last very long.
No, it sold to BrewDog, and then BrewDog's not doing too well with their PR right now. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah, and I'm more than happy to go there. But yeah, there are some bigger forces than beer coming down there. So in the vein of traditional, and you've been to Europe a number of times with, you know, you probably know the beer culture there better than most in craft beer. When it comes to things like Kolsch versus Kolsch style ale, like the labeling,
yeah,
you know, champagne,
yeah,
can't call it champagne.
Yeah.
I've heard cheddar, like that's outside of cheddar England, it's kind of not looked kindly upon.
I know there's a lot of conversation with what's going on right now, and I understand all sides. You know, should we be calling Czech beers Polet Mave or Tamave? You know, should we be just calling them amber and dark? That's pretty boring to me. It doesn't really give the consumer something to really hang their hat on. What do you say, Czech style dark, right? So there's that, you know, conversation. Are we supposed to call Helles just bright or light now? Because if we say Helles, like, well, we're appropriating the German language or German culture. Is Dunkel supposed to be dark? Right? You say Dunkel or Tamave, and those mean very different things. And I think it's important they have that different differentiation, that one's Czech dark and one's German dark. And I think that's that's appropriate for beer. Those are styles in of themselves. And so we've always just gone down that path of, if it's called Dunkel, we're going to call it Dunkel. Right? We're not going to say it's, you know, German style dark. Like, I don't know. It's that, again, just our point of view. Because I like styles, and I think styles communicate a lot of important things. I also understand that, you know, the Kolsch style ale, you know, and there are areas in Europe where they're very protective of what they've created, and I understand that, you know. So Kolsch should only be called Kolsch if you brew it in Cologne, and it should be Kolsch style. Okay, we'll throw style on the label. I think people are going to get the same message. You know, Pilsner is only brewed in Pilsen. You know, and that's the reason the Germans don't call Pilsner Pilsner. They call it Pils. It's like, okay, you want that designation of Pilsner coming from Pilsen. That's fine. That's why Czech Republic drinks pale lager. We know it as Pilsner, right? But that's a lot of minutia. So in some ways I'm on board with that minutia. In other ways I'm like, well, it's kind of taxing on the consumer. So I don't know where I land, other than I think styles are important, and we just tend to use the style name as is in the home country. But I mean, some Czech, I mean, we call our pale lagers pale lagers. You know, because it's really hard to say pale lager in the Czech Republic, in the Czech language.
Yeah, I never thought about taking it as far as even Helles or just words in from a foreign language.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking of it in the way of Kolsch versus Kolsch style, you know, calling something a goose versus, you know, goose inspired, or, you know, the different ways to do that. Yeah. But that's a good point of, language is important.
I think they are. So, but also, what's important, what's the origin? I think the motivations there are that let's not fool people with the origin of where this is coming from. But I don't know.
That's
if
another
it says
line to
Salem,
cross.
Massachusetts, Kolsch, I think you know it's not coming from Cologne.
Yeah, you know, if you're deceiving people to thinking that it's from somewhere else, then that's a whole nother level of marketing, I guess we could put it kindly. So you won the Boston best Boston brewery.
We won best of Boston 2022 for best brewery.
Okay.
My understanding is that's Boston Magazine. Mm-hmm. And my previous brewery, Tremont, I think we won it 5 times. So it was a pretty long gap in between the last time I won it and winning it. So it's kind of, it was really cool for me. Like, wow, we won best of Boston. It's a different brewery in a different neighborhood. But my understanding is that the beer writer, the magazine writer who's responsible for that category, always pitched Notch and Salem to win Best of Boston. But I guess the editors of Boston Magazine were like, it's too far away, it's not close enough, it can't be Best of Boston because it's a 40-minute drive. Like, okay. And then the opportunity came about when we opened Brighton that, you know, now we're brewing in Boston that we can get that. So I understand that, you know. The best thing, you know, I love the recognition, that's great, but there's no such thing as the best anything. Like, it's just, there's a class of, like, really good, great, maybe excellent, but taste and what you enjoy is so subjective. How can anything be the best? Right? So
yeah.
I just take that as, like, recognition. You know, Notch did really well. The brewery's doing, you know, producing good beers. The experience is good, so they gave us best. Something different would be best next year. Great. So it's kind of like it gets carried all over the place, and that's why I think it's the way it should be.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot more. Well, maybe not a lot more, but there's more competition than when you were doing this back when there was 3 breweries in Boston.
So, in Boston, when Tremont opened in 1993. There were 2 other breweries in Boston, Harpoon and Sam Adams R&D facility. And there were a couple of brew pubs as well, Beer Works and a couple other ones. But production breweries, there were 3. And it was a long time before the 4th opened up, and that was Trillium as a production brewery. And so Boston was always thought of being like, you know, it's a great beer town. I was like, I always said, what are you talking about? And the per capita is the lowest amount of breweries in the country. Like, it's really under represented. But now, you know, part of that's the cost of real estate. Boston land-wise isn't very big. It's not like, you know, Phoenix, where it's like 10,000 square miles is the city. And Boston's pretty dense and small. So, you know, I think now that the surrounding metropolitan area of Boston has a lot of breweries, it's competitive in a way that, you know, hasn't been in a long time. I mean, there's 9,000 plus breweries in the United States. I lost count of the ones in Massachusetts. You know, I used to know every brewery. I think I know maybe a fifth of them right now. Because there's so many, but you know, it's a sign that, you know, tap rooms really resonated with with customers in a way that restaurants weren't. In the tap room experience, generally, and I hate to put generalizations of things, but generally it's more relaxed. It's a coffee shop, you know, kind of serves beer. You know, food's not the focus. It's about beer and community, and you can hang at your table as long as you want. You're not getting a tab at the, you know, end of an hour saying, you got to go, we got to turn this table. So I think that's kind of a general kind of feel of tap rooms. But because there are so many, you know, we just talked about the beginning of the podcast, you really need a strong point of view. Like, people walk in the door, you got to feel different. If the consumer walks in and says it's another generic tap room experience, like, why are they going to come back if they can get that experience anywhere? So I'm seeing a lot of that now. I'm seeing a lot of things just kind of being replicated. And I'll never understand why you open a brewery and it's like, I really like what the guy's doing two towns away. We're going to do the same thing. Like, I don't understand that viewpoint. Like, you, if you're really going to grab customers, you got to be doing something pretty unique, and the beer's got to have an interesting point of view, and the experience has to be, you know, a strong experience. So, I don't know. I also understand just the pure joy of opening a brewery. Like, there's a lot of just pure joy, like, of seeing people drink your beer. It's second to none, and then saying they really like your beer. So I know that a lot of people just, they want to be brewers, they want to open breweries, but I'm fearful that we're going to open a lot of breweries that just have a, you know, unique point of view, and the consumer's going to think every brewery is the same, which they're not wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you have that kind of sense of joy getting this place finally going, especially with a delay from the COVID times?
Yeah, I mean, we weren't sure this was going to happen. So we started the Brighton project in 2020. We broke ground, I think it was February. I just gotten back from the Czech Republic, and, you know, we broke ground shortly thereafter, and then, you know, 3 weeks later everything was shut down, and so we were already committed. I had a lot of money already tied up in this. A smart move might have been to walk away, but we have a nonprofit for a landlord, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I just want to push the pause button. They said, for how long? I said, I don't know. We pushed the pause button for 9 months. Did nothing. Didn't spend money. Construction was halted on our part of the building. And then we saw that the vaccine was going to be implemented, you know, in the spring of 2021, and there was a path towards, like, normalcy. That was naive, but it seemed like there was a path towards normalcy. And so we kicked up construction again, and, you know, we were able to open in July last year. And so, you know, it was not easy doing construction, as anyone knows, during the pandemic. I mean, access to materials, all costs went up. I think it was like crazy stuff too, like Texas not being on the grid and being independent in their energy consumption. They got hit with a storm, and basically you couldn't buy a refrigerator for like 9 months because Texas is where all insulated panels were. So that wasn't even COVID related. It was just these other kind of extraneous circumstances. But we got through it, spent a lot more money than we anticipated because of the cost of doing everything. But yeah, it wasn't fun to do it during the pandemic, but we were able to get it done.
Yeah. So this being second location, are you on two different water sources?
We are. So they're both surface water. So the Quabbin Reservoir is the reservoir that feeds Boston. And then we get our water from the Ipswich River, Ipswich Watershed in Salem. They're both very similar in water makeup. They're both extremely soft with slight elevation of calcium chloride, just because that's what we salt our roads with, and eventually that finds its way to surface water, which is a really good component to have in beer if you're making light, delicate, low ABV beers. Calcium chloride gives us really nice palate fullness, so it's not a bad thing. So yeah, we're really, really fortunate that our water sources are very similar. They're both soft. They both have very similar characteristics. So we really we don't treat our water at all. We use our raw water. We filter it because chlorine will be added at certain times of the year to make sure that you know, the water's safe. But we'll filter that out. So we take things out. We don't add anything to it.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering about that because I feel like there are enough places that have multiple locations that have to deal with that in somewhat significant ways.
Yeah.
And or they'll even not make one beer, you know, they'll keep one beer at one location, do other beers at other location because they don't want to have to balance between the two, I guess.
Yeah, we're fortunate we don't need to do that. In Brighton, we only make lager, and 99% of that is Czech lager. So the way we set up Brighton was we would focus on you know, multiple decoction, open fermentation, and then serve directly from lagering tanks. So all our beers in Brighton are served, well, most of them, Let me rephrase that. All of our Czech beers are served directly from lagering tanks. And then the other beers that are served here, we brew in Salem and bring down.
Okay.
So we have four Czech lagers on tap at any given time through Lucre Faucets. And then we have 10 other offerings that come from Salem as well. So.
Okay. So Lucre Faucets or side poles, you know, yeah, whatever you want to call them on social media and take the video and do all that stuff. Can you just explain the difference between, because I know this is, I've heard you talk about this before, the side pull versus slow pour?
Yeah, so the side pull is something I discovered when I was, one of my trips to Czech Republic, and I remember, I think it was the first time I was sitting in, I think it was the Golden Tiger in Prague, and I watched this guy pour like 10 half liters of beer in a minute, and they came out with this dense, creamy, foamy head, and drinking those beers was just a wonderful experience, and I watched him over and how he did it. And so, you know, fast forward to when we were going to build Salem, Evan Rail, who is a, you know, beer writer who lives in Prague, and we're friendly, and I asked him, hey, you know, where are these coming from? Because no one in the United States had these. This is 2014. I started figuring out how I was going to get these. And so Evan set me up with Lucre and the rep there, Jan. And I was afraid I'd have to be some language barrier, but there's none. So we ordered them, brought the first Lucre faucets and tower into the United States. And I wired money to a company I had no idea who they were, and hoped this box showed up, and it did. Fast forward, like, you know, it's like the trendiest thing on Instagram right now, or, you know, foam pours and whatnot. Yeah. But we did it because the functionality, not because it was Instagrammable. The functionality is such that in the United States, faucets here are this like piston assembly where it's more on-off. So you open it up, beer comes out, you close it, you know, beer turns off. Where the Lucre faucet is a ball valve, where you can restrict flow. When you restrict that flow, you create foam. And then that foam goes down into the downspout of the faucet and goes through a fine mesh screen that makes that bubble size uniform. And so it creates what's called wet foam, which is a dense, creamy, consistent foam. And so you pour that first, and then you turn the ball valve all the way on so clear beer comes out, and you put the clear beer below the foam level, so you're pushing the foam up. And that's important because you're not knocking CO2 out of the rest of that pour. You're keeping the CO2 level in the clear beer that's built under that foam at the level it's supposed to be at. The difference, you know, slow pours we don't do, and quite frankly, I don't really understand them that well, so again, I'm out of my range of talking, but my understanding is you're going to knock a lot of CO2 out of solution with the slow pour, so it doesn't happen with a Lucre pour. There's some confusion that the Lucre is also for slow pours. You don't need a Lucre faucet to do a slow pour. In fact, you shouldn't use a Lucre faucet for a slow pour. It's not what it was designed. It's not what it was designed for. But I guess you can do it.
Foam, and so I mean, you are actually often, or I guess with the Czech pours, generally going faucet into the beer.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah, that was a world of hurt when we started, because no one else was doing this. I mean, nobody else in North America was doing this. And so we started doing this in Salem, which is, you know, a great town, and it's forward with craft beer, but it's not like the craft beer mecca. So people are like, what are you doing? You can't do that. Like Cicerones would come in and be like, that's bullshit, you can't do that. I learned that in Cicerone training, you can't do that. It's like, well, this is different.
Yeah.
These are designed to do exactly this. The faucets are removable and you can clean them. Unlike US faucets, which you can't take apart and put in the, you know, into a cleaning regime each night. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just threw a lot of, you know, kind education to our customers, like, this is what's happening here, and this is why you can do this. And for the first few years, we would post our Lucre faucet pours and show how they're done. Again, Cicerone alert, hey, you can't put that faucet in the beer. And we'd have to explain it. No, over time, then what we saw is we gathered a lot of fans, and then this is the best on Instagram, was that our fans started defending us, and we didn't have to. We didn't need to. And then people are like, hey, this is what's being done. This is why that's important, et cetera, et cetera. So a little bit easier today, you know, in the current, you know, craft beer world, but still, you know, still an educational challenge to not everyone's on board with that.
Yeah. There are plenty of places where I go, and like my first thought is like, is that glass clean enough, first of all? And then if I see the foam hitting the perlick, I'm like,
No.
I don't know about this.
Yeah.
I think I might not finish this one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that go wrong in draft beer if you don't pay attention to it. Yeah. Maybe we've all had off beer at some sketchy places.
Yeah. Yeah, there are places where I'm like, probably shouldn't have drank that beer. Probably shouldn't have gone in the front door. But, for the side pour, or the side pull, I'm gonna be mixing everything up with slow pour now for the rest of this conversation. Have you ever thought about just bastardizing and putting like a style that wouldn't normally be seen on a side pull?
We have done that, not a lot, but once in a while we'll throw something on the Lucre faucet, one for speed, because you can pour a lot faster. These have the diameter of the faucet's much wider, so you can pour at a much faster rate. So another brewery locally here that has, I think their tap room has all Lucre faucets, and it's not for the pour, it's just to pour fast. And that's, the functionality that you can't beat. But for us, we'll do a Scottish sweet stout and an Irish stout the spring. And we'll use a Lucre faucet for that, because you can replicate like a nitrogen pour, even though we're not doing anything with nitrogen. That's a fun way to do it.
That was my thought, like an oatmeal stout or something
like
that.
Yeah, it definitely works for that, yeah. I mean, we're purists, but we're not absolutists either. It's like there's wiggle room. You can still breathe and have fun,
Yeah. So for different styles, I see Notch on, social media and stuff that you post, and I've had enough of your beer. I'm like, this is, authentic. I mean, I've never been to Czech Republic or Europe, but like this is, I feel like, as authentic as I can find, and you're very open about your brewing styles and why they're important, and probably also to a degree that I don't see you releasing, hazy IPA with gummy worms and whatever other shit.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a pickle beer yet, so that's all. That's if when people ask what the new trend is, I guess you can say pickle beer, at least as of this week.
I don't even know that, so I'm kind of sad you even told me that.
I don't know. You can just forget it that I said that, but to the point of authenticity, and not deceiving a customer, but being authentic in the way that you're brewing. Can you speak to the importance of authenticity of craft beer?
Yeah, and authenticity is it's a word that's it can be a little loaded in terms of what do you mean by authenticity? Is it traditional? I mean, traditional, you need to tell what year that was, right? Because traditions change over time. So authenticity, I think, for us, it means that we're open and honest with our processes and what we do, and we try to pay homage to these styles in a way that respects them and doesn't bastardize them, and I think it's important, at least what I think it's important to keep that going. Like you talked about, you haven't been to the Czech Republic, and a lot of people haven't been able to travel the last few years, so we'd like to give an experience that, again, not Disney World, but at least, gives them a sense of like how that looks and feels. And I think that's important, that, if you're saying you're doing X, whatever that is, you're making British cask beer, or you're making, naturally carbonated, spunded, Zwickel beer, or whatever you want to make, that, you're true to like that process and that beer, so that you don't confuse people. And that's, once you start confusing consumers about process by not doing the process the way we were telling them it should be done, then people get confused and you lose them. So, I've never really thought about that when we started doing that in Salem. I just knew I had these beers I had to get out of me, that I've been a brewer for a very, very long time. And, I didn't have the ability to do decoction. I've done open fermentation my entire career, but that was for, not lager. We developed a brew house, and especially built a brew house so that we could do multiple decoctions and cereal mashes. And so then building on that, open fermenting those beers. And then over time, like the first year, just developing a unique process of open fermentation married with spunding and natural carbonation, which I never heard anyone else doing, but I just kind of did it because, one, it was practical, because you got the aromatics you want from open fermentation, and the yeast behaves in a certain way from the open fermentation and the geometry of the tank. But then also being allowed that beer to use its CO2 that's being created to naturally carbonate the beer, so we'd be able to blend both of those things. And then horizontal lagering, et cetera. So a lot of these process things that we were able to bring into play that, yeah, they're authentic, but they were implemented from us because we were trying to make really great beer, and there's no shortcuts. Like, I knew those processes had to be put in place to get to result in, you know, a final product. And it's not just one thing that will impact that final product. You know, I've been asked a number of times, is it decoction that makes your beer special, or is it like this or that? And like, it's not one thing. It's the sum of all those things. It's a sum of like 30 things you do in the course of a brew day, cellaring and packaging, that make beers great. There's no magic bullet. So I think we're able to, through this lens of like authenticity and some traditional Bavarian Czech methodology, that we were able to land on that. A lot of trial and error, you know, making the same beer over and over and over again and doing process tweaks until you realize we're there, right? And so I don't know how we could have done that if we did a different beer every single time.
Yeah. You said something earlier, really early in this conversation about, to that point of, you know, doing the same beer over and over. How often, if you, well, I mean, like you said, every year ingredients change. It's an agricultural product. But how often are you or were you adjusting a recipe, even like the standard or beers that you constantly have available?
So it's a good question. So some of these evolved because we started as a contract brewer. Right? When I started Nosh in 2010, because I'd owned a brewery before, been a brewer for a long time, there was no way I was going to unleash a new beer brewery with a unique point of view without proving it out first. I wasn't going to raise $1 million and open a brewery and hope that it worked. That's, to me, is madness. So we took, you know, the first 3 years and did it on a contract basis and got feedback. So a lot of these beers evolved in breweries that didn't have decoction capability, and so we had to do the best we could. But we didn't brew a lot of lager during that time because we just didn't have the capabilities. I think the only beers that remain from that, you know, early contract time is probably Cherny Pivo. But Cherny Pivo evolved. It was originally a 10 Plato beer. Then became a 10-12 Plato beer. It wasn't decocted. But then I got it to Salem, and I was like, all right, we're going to make this beer how we should make it. So that one evolved over time. So we brewed Cherny Pivo. I just had coffee so far today. I think I've got the jitters. Cherny Pivo we've been brewing for 11 years, and that has definitely, you know, changed. It's been the same for the last 6 years. We haven't changed, you know, but initially it did change quite a bit. The standard, for example, was the first multiple decocted pale lager we did in 2016, and that recipe has not changed at all, except for we have experimented with different floor malted Czech malt over the years to see if the flavor profile is what we want, and then maybe some IBU adjustment, you know, here or there, but that's about it. Otherwise, the structure of that beer, the bones of that beer have not changed.
Okay. Well, you're talking about Czech floor malted malt. Can you make an authentic Czech beer like the way that you know Czech beer can be without using Czech ingredients?
I think you can.
This is kind of a trap question because there are people on both sides. But
I'm coming around to the idea that you can. Initially, I was like, no, you need to do it like by the letter. And, you know, if you're not decocting, I'm not really sure if floor malting is going to lead you to any benefit. But there's something about Czech malt in itself that has a unique character. But that's the seed, like the barley variety, and that can be grown anywhere. So it doesn't need to be grown there. Have you seen the movie Kiss the Ground?
I don't think so.
It talks about soil and how. As a society, we basically are killing our soil through, you know, industrial agriculture. And, you know, the more I look at that and the more I see how global warming is having an effect on our society just by transporting stuff a long way, I'm just starting to think that, you know, there may be opportunities for us to do things that, you know, get U.S. agriculture away from industrialized, you know, grain. Because for the most part, the U.S. grain has been it's neutral as hell, but it's not very flavorful. So I think there's a pathway that we could get grain here that, you know, exhibits a lot of the same characters. I don't think we're there yet, but I definitely think it's possible. Yeah. But we've leaned heavily into using Czech malt only right now, from a couple different sources. But I am going to start experimenting with U.S. grown varieties, heritage varieties, and see how that yields, how that flavor is.
Okay. I mean, if you can get the same malt from, you know, Western Mass or Maine or wherever, you can make the same beer with it, then that's a lot easier, probably a lot cheaper.
I'd rather keep that money in our economy, and I'd rather employ local people and not send our dollars overseas, right?
Yeah, so I think of the...
That's very real.
Yeah, I think of the Allagash, like the 1 million pounds of... I think it's specifically Maine-grown grain that they hit, and just kind of transforming the way that we think about it. I mean, being out here, it's a long ways from, you know, Western Canada and, you know, even Minnesota, Wyoming, wherever your grain is coming from. If you're buying American grown or Western Canada, there's a long way away. And it's a conversation I had recently was, you know, can you even call that local when that's going into your beer?
Yeah.
You know, there's 75 layers of argument to go through when you want to call something local beer, and this is local, that's local, this isn't local, that I think is probably a book's worth of conversation in that alone. But
well, the most important thing that when you make a beer in a brewery in a town that's local is the labor.
And that was one point that was made that I never thought of was the labor.
I had battles with bar owners in Boston who were just convinced, like, well, your ingredients come from all over the world, it's not really local. I said, well, the labor's local, that counts for something. And they didn't like that.
Because that was outside of their thinking, their perspective.
It was an excuse they were using for not having local beer. And so if you had something that could challenge them, they didn't want to challenge. They thought they knew all. So, but, you know, I understand it. Again, I think moving as best we can to local, there's nothing that's bad about that inherently.
Yeah. So you mentioned the different styles, you know, different, you know, the Czech pale lager, all the different styles that are local to other places that, you know, we enjoy. Recently you did Punto. They called it a Caribbean style lager, which I'd never heard of. I've heard of tropical stout, but I mean, obviously, styles are all over the place. That beer was delicious, but what makes a Caribbean style lager?
So, this is kind of a segue to, like, you know, other like lager conversations, in that there's a couple styles I don't understand. I'll never understand Italian Pilsner. That's a whole other conversation. One I don't really like. There's very few of them I like. There's a few I do like a lot, but 98% of them they're too floral for me. I don't really like that character. And that's a personal opinion. Doesn't make the beers not valid. And then Mexican lager, like, I always scratch my head. It's like, is that just U.S. brewers, like, finally admitting that, you know, light lager with corn is cool, but it sounds sexier if you call it Mexican?
It sounds exotic.
Lots of appropriation going on with that direction, too, but...
Yeah.
So, and, Punto Pils came
every Cinco de Mayo, it's...
Yeah, some bad labels out there.
Yeah.
So Punto's Pils came about because in Salem, we abut a neighborhood called The Point. And The Point has long been an immigrant community that provided labor for the mill, this massive mill across the street. Initially, it was Polish, it was French-Canadian, it was Russian. And then over time, it became Dominican, Puerto Rican. And so it's called Punto, which is, you know, Spanish for point. And so there's a mural program there that's internationally known. It's 50 murals on the sides of the buildings called the Punto Urban Art Museum. And so we decided to brew a beer where the proceeds would go to the Punto Urban Art Museum, because we stare at it every day across the river in the harbor. And then, you know, so we did that for a couple of years. And the approach there was that we did it for a couple of years. We're still doing it. The approach there is that we looked at some Caribbean lagers, Red Stripe, Presidente, et cetera. And so we gathered all the ones that we could from you know, different islands, and there was a, you know, predominantly bent in that they were a little bit sweeter than what you would find, like a Bud Light, even like some Mexican lager. So they had this residual sweetness, and so we kind of said, all right, let's make a beer that's kind of reflective of the beers consumed in that community. And then Julie Pena, who was our lead brewer in Brighton, it's from the Dominican Republic, and she brewed it this year as well. So she's finally kind of came full circle that, you know, Punto Pils was brewed by a native of the Dominican Republic. So I felt good.
Okay. A question that I'd had a little bit earlier, but that's the perfect segue. Your last head brewer was a woman, and you now at each location, I believe, have a woman as head brewer.
So I'm the head brewer, but okay. We have lead brewers.
Lead brewers, okay.
And production managers. Okay. So, you know, I just call myself head brewer because I'm the one, I do the recipes. We share the recipes at some point. Now I don't do all the recipes, but I'm the one, at the end of the day, I'm the one responsible for production. So Brianne Allen was our old production manager in Salem. Brianne's went on to start her own brewery in Maine. And now we have two female lead brewers. So in Brighton, Julie's our lead brewer here. And then Anna is our lead brewer in Salem. And they've been with us now for about a year and a half.
Okay.
So, and it's not planned. It just...
That was where I was going. Is it like proactively working towards, you know, I mean, there's not many female head brewers. I mean, it's very disproportionate and probably no more than a handful of places with multiple locations that have female lead brewers or, yeah. You know, in charge.
Well, and, you know, the hope is that they eventually become head brewer. It just takes a while to get there. And so that I'm happy to relinquish that title. It's not really important to me. And they both become head brewers at their respective breweries. And, you know, for me, it's just been diversity. Yeah, sure. If we can make our company more diverse, I'd like to do that because I don't want to just have a bunch of, you know, white dudes sitting around the table making the same jokes, brewing the same beers. There's nothing that really adds to that. You know, so
you got the flannel and I got the beard. So
yeah,
we got it covered.
Right. So, I've always had a thought that, you know, a diverse workplace, you know, yields better results, and you get to challenge yourself that you just don't have like a, you know, sounding board that's going to repeat the same things back to you. So, but the other is that when I look for brewers, we've just been fortunate that we've had some really high quality applicants that just happen to be female. You know, so we've had female brewers, you know, but I think now we've had 1, 2, 3. This is our fifth, you know, 7 years in Salem, we've had, you know, 6 female brewers that, you know, some have gone on to other things and some left the industry to be a scientist and, you know, things like this. So,
yeah, I was just wondering.
This scale of brewing is a hard gig. So if you can hang on for a few years.
Yeah. You're not getting rich at this size.
I mean,
business.
Well, I think our, just to, you know, allow Notch a little bit of platform here. I think we are one of the most competitive in salaries and benefits for a brewery our size. So, yeah, I feel good about that.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if it was just, you know, being proactive in that way, which, I mean, all of these issues can become sticky conversations, or if it was just you got great, you know, the right people at the right time.
I think it's right people, right time. But also, a lot of the brewers that we've hired over the years have been regulars. They're from other breweries, but they come to Notch a lot and hang, and that's a sign they really like the beer. You know, so that's a good way to do it.
It's a good start.
Yeah. But the Pink Boots organization, we always advertise through them, and so I think that puts us into a into some awareness that maybe we didn't get otherwise. You know, and because a lot of hiring is just networking. So if you're a white dude, you're going to network with other white dudes, and then you're going to hire white dudes. And again, nothing wrong with that. I'm a white dude, but you're not going to bring in somebody who has a fresh perspective on things.
Yeah, I wrote a piece recently on basically that topic, and it was really eye-opening to talk to people about and kind of realize, like, if you hang out with the same people, you're getting nothing new. And, you know, taproom crowds are becoming more diverse.
Yeah,
but
I see that here in Brighton. It's a really diverse crowd that comes here, and it makes me really happy. This is the community. Like, it's like, just because of the nature of Boston, and we're in the middle of a bunch of colleges. We don't really attract college students. We get the faculty, and the faculty is very diverse. So it's really encouraging to see that.
Well, and in this metro area, you've got some of the smartest people in the world coming here for bioscience and technology and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
it's terrifying giving them a tour.
Yeah, I I kind of joke every time I'm here, I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm lowering whatever town I'm in's IQ. And like, I walk through Cambridge and I'm like, they're going to catch on and I'm going to get kicked out of here. But yeah, I mean, to what you said, the diversity brings new opinions, new perspectives.
Yeah.
And it's really for the better.
No,
and
I mean, I get challenged. You know, I get challenged as much as I think I'm very forward thinking. You have your history and your blinders, and it's always good to like open that up.
Yeah.
Find new ways.
Yeah, which really, I think, leads to, you know, important conversations and the betterment of whatever it is, whether it's your beer or your food, if you're a restaurant, or your, you know, whatever business it is.
Yeah.
That it's not going to hurt from a little increased diversity in conversation. I don't know if you have like a 5-year plan, but you know, being pretty new here with this location, you know, there's always the next thing. But do you have a plan for what's next for Notch?
Well, our 5-year plan got, you know, I think everyone's 5-year plan got blown up during the pandemic. And it was. I'll be lying if I say it was like it wasn't difficult. It was really, really hard. You know, to get through that, and you were in survival mode for, you know, a good amount of that time. And so coming out of it, we're still just now just kind of like getting up off our knees after being punched in the gut, you know, by everything that happened. Last winter was, I think a lot of people share this sentiment, last winter was harder than the first winter because we thought it was over and we were open, and then all our customers got sick and our staff got sick, and then we had like 2-3 months of just no business, but all of the expenses. So we're still getting, you know, past that. So as we get into this year, we feel like there's some normalcy happening. We're just now taking a look at, you know, what are the next steps? Because it was really just to save the business. I'm not sure how many people are honest about that, but the last 2 years, like, save the business. Make sure we're stable. You know, make sure that we're doing things we need to do to have longevity, because that's the most important thing. You know? So I don't know. I think we'll probably get through this year and over the winter, just, you know, get a sense of what the next steps are. Yeah, so now 5-year plans became, you know, 4-month plans. You know, how do we get through this next, you know, this next wave or this next, you know, directive or et cetera, et cetera. But it feels good. I mean, in September, we were, Salem was up 27% over the previous year. That feels really good. We're not back where we were in 2019 yet, but that's a pretty good jump. And Brighton, you know, we finally have year-over-year numbers, and we're up, you know, pretty significantly over the previous year. So we're in the right trajectory. Yeah. Everyone just go get their 5th shot before the winter.
Yeah.
We'll all be good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm old. I have 5 shots. Anyways, get the updated booster.
Yeah. So totally different spin to finish it up. You, when I messaged you about doing this one, you said something about being in a band, and I feel like that always, there's always like an artistic connection in some way with, whether it's music or, you know, whatever other outlets there are that people have outside of beer. But I always wonder how those influence what you do here. And the music, I know that, you know, a lot of the labels are music inspired, and
yeah,
how does does music influence your beer, or is it more the vibe and the culture here?
I mean, I think it's all of that. You know, we always had fun with our playlists, so we have a very curated playlist in both our locations that we don't deviate from, but our staff also, you know, contributes to them. So our staff creates the playlist. I have one playlist, so everyone can know, like, just do something in this vein. It can be current. It can be slightly varied from that. And so we didn't want to have, you know, I go to some places and the music's so distracting. It's like, wow, is anyone paying attention at all? You know, we also didn't want it to be trendy, as I talked about. But, you know, the music creates the vibe. And that also informs, you know, a lot. If we do a non-lager, typically our lagers are just, you know, Helles, Dunkel. We name the style, don't name the beer, with some exceptions. If we do a pale ale or something at the non-lager, we typically just pull on a music reference. You know, it could be a song or a band album title or something like that. And then that may, you know, manifest itself into the label itself. And just fun. You know, it's fun to do that. You know, but I think most brewers come from a creative, they come from either a science background or a creative background. And that kind of, you know, they both work. I mean, it's, every brewer will tell you this for the last 30 years. It's like it's a, the blend of creativity and having a good, you know, solid foundation in the technical aspect of brewing. So I'm sure that, that, you know, that kind of comes into a little bit. But did I cancel our last thing because I had something going on?
No, we just, we never had anything scheduled.
Okay, good.
We were just working around a date.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, there are definitely places I've been where I walk in and grab a beer and then the music kind of starts to set in and I'm like, what the fuck are we listening to? I can't
it's
sit
to me
here
it's like,
and do anything.
It's the same as if you walk into a bar and the television is playing like an infomercial because someone just forgot that the game was over.
Yeah, it's like a shitty movie from like 2004 that's on whatever channel.
Yeah, so we pay a lot of attention. We do live music in Brighton on Thursday nights. It's all local music. When we do reels, you know, it's the real world now. And Instagram, all the music that we put on the reel is local music, local acts that we get approval for. Typically, they're playing the tap room that week.
Yeah, so, you just had a reel the other day that I clicked on the band that was used as the music, and it was like their description was whatever. I don't remember who they were, but it was something from Boston.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's awesome that it's that part of it is, you know, a local, you know, connection, local music, whatever. Yeah. It's not just whatever's trending on Instagram.
Right. No, we won't go down that path. Our reels are not going to be like what you typically see. They're us. It's us doing that because that's what Instagram, that's the only way you get views is to make it a reel. So we just do short movies that are basically movies about our
There's
company.
No such thing as a video post anymore. It's just automatically a reel.
Right. All right. So, I mean, a lot of our staff are musicians. You know, a couple have played the tap room, a couple of Salem musicians. Cody, who's server here, is also a local promoter, music promoter, and plays in bands. And so it's, you know, it's just kind of integrated into the company. And it's not forced. It's just kind of there.
Yeah. But I think that's probably why it works, because that's just, you're not forcing weird things and, you know, whatever. I don't even know what song is trending right now, but I guess I know it's not in your reels.
It's definitely not. So I mean, it's just, we take a lot of time and effort to make sure that, you know, we're true to ourselves and not just, again, on trend isn't important. Being true to ourselves in a way that's current in a way that people want to be involved, but not trendy.
Yeah, I don't plan on ever seeing Notches going viral on social media, and I think that's probably
the closest we get is when we do a Luke or four, and people start going off about how we're doing it wrong, or like, something like that. And that's we get a lot of eyeballs that way.
Yeah, for better or worse, I guess.
Chris Loring, founder and head brewer at Notch Brewing, Salem and Brighton, Massachusetts. If you don't know Notch, then you probably haven't been on social media ever. But Notch makes a lot of really good lager styles, which they're known for. But they make a hell of a pickled veggie plate, too. So don't sleep on the pickled veggie plate. But they also make other styles. I think there were actually two cold IPAs on draft the last time I was there, of which I drank neither. So, yeah, they do a lot of things. Although, I don't know how they brew their cold IPAs, so argue amongst yourselves about what that even means. Anyway, lots of lower alcohol beers, very drinkable styles, low strength, just sessionable beer for the most part. It's a very conducive place to hanging out for long periods of time. They also have lots of events, live music I think every week, a lot of room for activities. The point is, if you get the chance, check it out. The beer and the kind of place that make you wish you lived a little closer. But I think that's going to be it for this episode. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Chris for joining me. Again, thank you to Hopped Up Network for having me on. You can find other beer podcasts at hoppedupnetwork.com. Plenty more episodes coming from the Northeast, including places you've never heard of and places you've definitely heard of. So get automatic downloads. Make sure you subscribe wherever it is that you are listening. You can check out the show on Instagram at beertruth.podcast. And until the next round, thanks again. Cheers.